I did not bring a mouse today, so this is going to be awful.
I have a mouse. Do you want to borrow a mouse?
It's not the only mouse you have, right? So you're not going to sit there all dejectedly staring at me just...
It is going to be the only mouse that I have.
We could probably steal one of the mice from these computers.
Oh, yeah. That's a mouse.
Yeah. Nobody's going to use them today, so...
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
All right. I'll probably do that. So, or how about I'll take Charlotte's, and then you have to use the crappy mouse.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Welcome to the Flyover Indies podcast, where Kansas City area game developers talk about what we're playing, what we're making, and what we're learning. And just by listening, you are part of the game development process, especially if you give us feedback on Twitter or email or via Discord, if you're a member of the Discord, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. So start churning in your brain all the feedback you want to give us. Positive feedback would be great.
Preferably.
So today we've got three Kansas City area game developers sitting around ready to chat. Very, very excited. First, we've got Charlotte Tribble, co-founder of Flyover Indies and game developer. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic.
Pretty good.
Yeah. And we've also got Joe Hanna, co-founder of Flyover Indies and game developer. How are you, Joe?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Awesome. And I am Caleb J. Ross. I'm a member of Flyover Indies and a kind of game developer. And I'm also doing well. So that's great.
Caleb, we're all a kind of game developer.
I guess that's true, which the listener will probably realize very, very shortly as we get into what we've been playing and what we've been learning from it. Also, what we've been working on. And at the end, if we have time, which I hope we do, because I'm really excited about it, we'll do a little game.
I like games.
Yeah.
That is kind of how I got here.
That's important. This will be not of the video variety, unfortunately.
I'm out.
Well, looks like we got a winner. All right. So let's start off by talking a little bit about what we've been playing. And I kind of want to toss to Joe first, because I'm looking at the notes. You have been playing Sweet Home. I've heard a lot about it. Tell us about it. What's going on with it?
Sure. Sweet Home is a game that was made for the Famicom. So it's really, really old. It is considered to be the first entry in the Resident Evil series by a lot of fans. I don't know necessarily the specifics of like the people that made it. It was sort of like one of the designers of Resident Evil's first exploration into sort of a lot of the horror genre tropes that would, well, horror genre ideas that would later become tropes. I don't know. I really like it. I kind of revisit it every year around Halloween because it's my favorite horror game. I've actually kind of more recently been playing a game called Inscription.
I've been playing that too.
Okay. Oh. Let's see. I mean, I suppose, like, for the sake of listeners, actually, Charlotte, have you played it?
I haven't played it, but I'm fully spoiled.
Excellent.
But we also might, yeah.
Oh, no, I mean, listeners.
Not that we're going to spoil you, but.
Oh, yeah, how far are you?
I've gotten far enough to know that I'm terrible at it and probably not going to be able to finish it. So if you want to spoil away. I've got to the second boss, I guess, the angler guy.
Okay.
Which is pretty early, I'm just very bad at it.
We're not talking about Inscription. sorry, listeners. I am not going to spoil anything for Caleb. It is really good, though. I think that, I guess I could talk about like the kind of mechanics that you are currently experiencing.
Sure.
I find them to be a little lackluster. The card game mechanics themselves, I think that like, at that point of the game, they're kind of limited, but I'm surprised at how well it works anyway. It's one of those things where I think as a designer, I tend to overcomplicate things. Mm. And so I will play things that have very like simple, straightforward mechanics. I mean, it's basically Magic the Gathering's combat, like creature combat system with persistent damage. And that's pretty much it. A game's mechanics can be both familiar and they don't have to be novel in order for somebody to enjoy playing them. Even somebody like me who is constantly like looking at mechanics and pulling them apart, I can still enjoy sort of the act of putting down creatures and making them fight each other, even if it is sort of, it doesn't have too much originality to it. I mean, the rest of the game is like incredibly original, but like just that sort of aspect of it, that like core loop is, I find it to, I wish that there was just a little more stink to it, I guess. But
the thing is, I don't know if it's a card game thing that pulls me away from it. Like, maybe I'm not as much of a fan of deck builders as maybe I thought I was, but there seems to be an element, two things kind of have pulled me away from it. There seems to be an element of randomness that for a lot of deck builders isn't there. Like, I feel like in most deck builders, you could sort of curate a deck in a way, mm-hmm. in a much more methodical, logical kind of way. And I feel like with this one, it's much more random. And that might be because I just haven't applied a conscious strategy to it. Like, I'm not necessarily... So there's a mechanic in the game where you can actually sort of merge two cards together to create one sort of better card, hopefully. And I kind of just do that randomly. I'm like, I'll just pick this card and that card, whatever. So it's probably my fault that I'm not really putting thought into exactly what I'm doing to merge these cards to make them better. I also, the other thing that I think pulls me away from it is it sort of violates a heuristic that... I don't want to say violates. It sort of skirts around a heuristic, the sort of recognition, not recall heuristic in just user interface in general, user experience in general. And that's the sigil icons on the cards are meant to reflect certain powers. So, for example, they're each card or some cards might have a little icon that tells you that it flies, mm-hmm. you know, and so that it can fly over certain creatures and creatures on the ground can't defend against it. And that was pretty self-explanatory. I think if I remember correctly, it's just like an image of wings or something like that. So you're like, okay, that makes sense. But there's a lot of these that get thrown at you right at the beginning, and not all of them are very intuitive. Mm-hmm. And so I'm constantly mm-hmm. having to go back to their instruction manual, which has an interesting gameplay element to it. So maybe this is why. Maybe they want you to look at the instruction manual a lot, but I have to keep going back to the instructions screen, I guess, not really a manual. To me, that sort of pulls me out of it in a way that's not very engaging. I'm constantly having to go back and say, okay, what was that again? Let me scroll through these 50 sigils and figure out which one it is. Oh, it's that one. Okay, now I go back. I wish there would have been some sort of hover over mechanic or something like that maybe would allow me to remember that.
So there actually is a hover over mechanic. I think if you click on the sigil, or possibly if you right click the sigil on a card, the manual will pop up on the page for that sigil.
Well, good thing I have editing power on this podcast. No, that's super helpful.
I mean, it doesn't explain that to you ever, so it would totally be easy to miss, but yeah, it is very helpful.
But also in hindsight too, that's right clicking on things, especially in a game that is very dependent on clicking on stuff. That's its only real mm-hmm. input. I probably should have tried that.
I think not to embarrass you further, I think if you hover over the sigils, a little book icon shows up next to your cursor. So, you know,
I don't believe you.
The more you know.
But yeah, it's really fun. Like I said, I'm terrible at it, so I don't know if I'll actually end up getting any further. It might be one of those games that I just kind of have to watch someone else play, like on YouTube or something, to kind of like. But I was having fun up until I couldn't progress anymore because I'm terrible.
I had to be pushed to progress in that game, and I would push you to try to.
Is there persistence after the death, like in a way that becomes important? So persistence in terms of your inventory or powers, that sort of thing after you die?
Yeah.
That's important?
It definitely has those sort of like roguelike elements where the game just sort of gets easier as you go along. As you beat bosses, they sort of get sad about having being beaten and start to like, I don't like the trapper, for instance. Oh, that's a spoiler. At some point the trapper's wares get cheaper. You get persistent items for beating bosses sometimes that will like help you in every run. The different things that you unlock in the cabin are persistently unlocked. And also I think the pool of cards that you have to draw from gets bigger and the cards get better. And then of course, you know about the like death card mechanic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, those eventually get busted.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the way that I ended up, beating the, cabin guy, Leshy is his name. But the way that I ended up beating Leshy was, I basically had a death card that had, I think like 4 or 5 power and also triple strike and cost, I think, 1 blood.
Oh, nice.
So it was just one of those things where as soon as I placed that death card on the board, I mean, that was it.
Basically. Okay, I am definitely going to give it another shot because as soon as you said something gets busted in the game, that's my kind of game. I want to get overpowered and I want to not think it. Like RPGs for me are 90% grinding in the first like third of it and then just coasting for the rest of it. And that's the kind of game I like. So, all right, I'll give it another shot. Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Charlotte, what about you? What have you been playing?
Gosh, I did a Halloween themed game recently. At least for me, it was sort of Halloween themed. Played through the rest of Luigi's Mansion 3, which was a lot of fun. I really love the vacuum mechanic. I could honestly just vacuum shit up in that mansion all day, every day. It's just so satisfying. But I did find that game also very frustrating in a lot of ways. Hmm. So I'm glad to be done with it finally, because that means if I decide to go back, I can just vacuum things for fun.
Yeah.
But the thing that I continually found myself struggling with was feeling like I didn't have enough of that feedback while playing of, hey, this is, you know, what you ought to be doing, or this is what you're doing wrong in this situation. Maybe I'm just dumb, but I was trying to remember a specific example. And I think there was this one boss at one point, might not even have been a full boss, but there was something to do with a stove in a kitchen, and you had to do something with fire or smoke or something like that. And I just remembered struggling for such a long time to figure out, what am I doing wrong in this fight? I just kept losing and being like, I don't even understand why I've lost and what I need to do differently. Just experimenting with different things and feeling like none of them is really helping show me, teach me through the game. And I ultimately ended up having to look up a lot of stuff in it, which was a little disappointing. But
was it unique to that one encounter that that the game wasn't providing the correct feedback, or you weren't receiving the correct feedback? Or
I feel like I had that a lot in the game. I was just not picking up on whatever cues they had, but I honestly feel like they just didn't have a lot of those kinds of things. You were talking earlier about having feedback on the cards, the UX of...
Did you try right-clicking on Luigi?
Yeah, I did, and it just didn't do anything. Yeah. I'm not sure what it was. But yeah, it's always little subtle stuff that can help along in situations like that. I want things to wiggle or move differently, or give me a different audio cue, light things up. Those sorts of things. Give me a hint, and I can start to run with it. Yeah, whatever reason, I was not meshing well with that aspect of the game. Still had fun. I would totally recommend it. But if you're feeling frustrated or stuck with it, just look it up. Yeah.
I haven't played the third one, but or the second one. But I remember from the correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember from the first one, all of the ghosts move in such a animated, silly, floppy kind of way. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like with a lot of them, you can do harmless things to them that cause them to sort of recoil. Uh-huh. And so is it one of those things where you are getting false feedback, sort of?
Perhaps. I just thought of another time when I was struggling in the game, and it was something with ghosts where as you found this one ghost and attacked and seemingly killed it, finally, yay, then it would apparently move to another room, and you had to go chase it down. And I didn't realize that every time it was moving to a room, it wasn't about the fact that I had tracked down and beaten this ghost and why is it back again? I kept doing this over and over and over again as it appears in one room and then the next room. And then this one finally clicked, but I had to play through it multiple times and was feeling stupider each time before I realized that the location in the room where you would find it hid in multiple spots, and you had to get just the right spot in each room. And it was the feedback there, at least to me, was that you had to guess the right one. And I hadn't made that connection of it's this room with multiple hiding spots, and I have to identify the hiding spot instead of a hiding spot. And so I was previously identifying one of the possible spots, but it wasn't the correct one as the game was concerned. And so I was just in this cycle of go to the room, find a ghost, the first place I find it, and realizing there's something about the potential hiding locations in this one room where only one of them is the solution.
Am I hearing correctly then that you as the player didn't receive any sort of feedback that indicated that that led you toward one guess as opposed to another. It was just a blanket guess.
Yeah, because I would find the ghost and be like, aha, I got you, and fight it, and then it's gone, and it appears again on the map, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. And like it goes through, I think it's like three, maybe four different rooms, and I just looped through these rooms multiple times before it was like, oh, there is something different in these rooms. And like there was some cue, but it was a subtle thing. And I hadn't known that I needed to look for that. Like whenever I was fighting and defeating the ghost, like there wasn't anything saying like, oh yeah, but no, until it was already done. Yeah. Didn't love that aspect of it. And who knows, maybe it does make a lot more sense to other players, but it definitely wasn't clicking in my brain at all.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
But sucking things up with that vacuum, very, very fun. Worth it for
that.
Have
you played the arcade game?
I have not, no.
There's one in, I think it's Overland Park, Olathe, one of their, at the Dave & Buster's, they have the arcade version of it. You get to hold a big vacuum, and it actually has a physical recoil when the ghost gets sucked into it. It's like, it feels
like fun.
Drinking bubble tea, you know, like the straws are... feel it. It's pretty cool.
That sounds great.
So for me, I'll try to be really quick, and then we'll jump into our main topic, which is, you know, why we even do game development. So stick around for that after this. But I've been playing also a spooky game that doesn't really sell itself as spooky necessarily. Doki Doki Literature Club. Have you guys played that?
I have not played it. I've heard really good things about it.
That game ruined my life.
Yeah, it's a little weird. So ostensibly, it's a dating simulator, and it sells itself as a dating simulator or a relationship builder or whatever you want to call it. That's what it sells itself as, and that's what I think, at least when it was first released, people probably went into it thinking it was. It definitely is that, I would say. It would still fit into that genre, but it does stuff with the genre toward the end especially that really twists it around and makes it very, very unique. To my understanding anyway, I'm not too terribly familiar with dating simulators, dating sims, but it does a lot of really, really interesting, crazy, weird stuff toward the end. A lot of triggery type stuff that you want to be prepared for. But what I felt was really incredible about it is that it was really strangely, because it doesn't, I'll use the term horror game to describe those elements toward the last half that are a little bit surprising. So I don't want to spoil anything, but when I say horror, I'm talking horror elements. I'm talking about the stuff that's way toward the end. Mm-hmm. So you play this dating sim, you're playing it for a few hours, maybe 2 or 3 hours, until it turns into its horror element type game. If you're a dating simulator fan and you're playing this game, you purchase this game, you're playing it for 3 hours and then turns to that, you'd probably be disappointed. If you're not a dating simulator fan and you've never heard anything about this game, you wouldn't be playing the game anyway. So really, it's aiming at people who had heard that there's something crazy about it and they want to experience it, which was where the camp I fell into. And that was why I played it. And so to me, it feels like a game that's almost not marketable. It's only marketable through word of mouth. Word of mouth is the only way to get people to play the game. And I think that's why people, there was no, like me as a player, if I wanted to recommend this to a friend, I couldn't say anything but just trust me. Mm-hmm. It's not what you think. Play it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because the game gets very meta as well toward the end. Horror elements gets very, very meta. And part of that meta is kind of making fun of the people who would be into a dating simulator game. And so if you are a fan of the dating simulator genre and you got into the horror elements and you're like, okay, I'll ride. It's not exactly what I wanted, but I'll get through it. If you did get through it, then you're like, come on, game, you jerk. Like, come on, I just want to play a game. That just really, 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 like, I don't know. It was really powerful to me to, like, see this game. Because I love the fact that games can still be meta. I guess that's kind of what I'm taking from it, is I felt like maybe after Undertale, anyone who tries meta would just be trying to copy Undertale.
It's like, are you playing the game, or is the game playing with you?
Right. And I love that that can still be a thing, that people can still find novelty in that approach, and they can still do that. I'm definitely a person who loves that sort of meta commentary on anything, and I don't want it to be played out. So this was refreshing to me to say, like, oh, it can still happen. It can still work. It was great. And then it also got me thinking about just, it plays with the idea of just the term relationship builder or relationship sim or relationship strategy game or whatever you want to call it, because by definition, games have credits, they have a goal, they have something you want to get toward, they have an end state that you want to get to. Mm-hmm. The idea of building a relationship should be, through a healthy mind, I think, something that doesn't have an end state. Like, you're not, there's no goal at the end of it. It's like, I just want to be in this relationship, right?
Yeah, the relationship
is the thing.
Yeah.
But a game has credits. So you have to do something. You have to manipulate conversation in some way to get to the end. And that manipulation is also played on in the game itself in a meta way. It's really kind of incredible, but it's also a game that I didn't think of as incredible until, like, after it was done. Even up through the very end, there's a weird, the whole thing is weird, but there's a weird, especially weird section at the end that I was roller coastering through, like, is this really happening? Is like, is this what I'm supposed to, what?
This is it, right?
It wasn't until after the credits rolled that I was like, oh, that was incredible. Oh, okay. That was incredible. And so I absolutely loved it. But yeah, that's sort of my takeaway, is that games can still be meta if they're creative enough. And I really am happy about that.
Cool.
You know, I never thought about the sort of marketing issue with that game. And I don't know what platforms it's available on now, but I mean, it was originally released for free.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It did not have a price on it when it was first released on Steam, which is how I first played it. So that kind of makes sense, you know? It's like, well, if you're incredibly disappointed or maybe horrified by this game, at least you didn't pay any money for it.
Yeah, yeah. And it being on PC is also important to note, because when it was first, I played it on Switch, which it still worked just fine on Switch, but it does have some elements that are very much meant to be played on a PC. It plays with sort of the folder structure of your computer in kind of interesting ways. And I never played it on PC, so I don't know if it actually leverages the real folder structure or if it's a facade kind of thing. Because on the Switch, it's just like a make-believe desktop background. Right. Like, it's not your actual desktop background. So I don't know if the PC actually does that or not.
It
does.
It totally does.
That's awesome. Yeah, see, that would have been a whole other level to it. That would have been amazing.
Cool. Yeah, that game.
Yeah, so it was really fun, but yeah, I recommend everyone play it. There are some now warning. Apparently, the original PC version did not have, like, trigger warnings at the beginning. This one does now, so it kind of ruins it almost in a weird way. It's like one of those things, like, you want warnings, but at the same time, the whole purpose of this game is to not warn you. I think they made the right call by putting that warning in there, but at the same time, it's like, I wish there was a way in which you wouldn't have to, but I totally understand and get why it would need it to be there, so... Anyway, awesome. So let's talk a little bit about why we do game development. I'm interested in this partially just because I'm interested in knowing more about the two of you, and I'm interested in being an egomaniac and talking more about myself. But also, I think, you know, if you're a first-time listener to this podcast and you started with episode one, it makes sense to sort of get to know us as developers, as people, a little bit to hopefully get you listening on to the next episode. So let's talk a little bit about, like, what draws us to game development, kind of what keeps us motivated, and possibly even what demotivates us. So I don't know. Let's start with you, Charlotte. Like, what kind of got you into game development? What was it?
Oh gosh, man. Like, so I've been interested in making games ever since I was a kid. Like a lot of kids, I played a lot of games. They were computer games, card games, board games, all sorts of games, tabletop games. And my dad actually had games that he had tried to make as well, like mostly board games, sometimes an RPG, because who doesn't want to try and do that at one point or another? And that influence definitely kind of, like, bled off on myself as well. And so I do remember being a kid and working on, like, I'm going to make my own RPG too. Like, I can do Dungeons and Dragons. Great. But also playing a lot of video games, I discovered the StarCraft map editor, like the level editor in there, and got to play around with, like, triggers and recording voices that you could play audio files through it. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was actually really, really robust, everything that you could do in there. And we had a microphone, and I definitely recorded, like, voice lines, and there were stories in the maps I was making and so forth. And just because of when I was growing up and being, you know, who I am, essentially, I got very interested in, well, I would like to make a video game. And for a long time, just kind of thought that wasn't really, really going to be an option. Like, I'm not strong in math, for instance. And I was constantly being told, hey, you know, if you want to program, you're especially if you want to make games, you're going to need to get better at math. And I was like, well, that's not going to happen. So I guess I'll stick to pen and paper stuff. But eventually I discovered through Joe, actually, kind of got me pointed back on this again, that there were free tools available to like Unity to help you actually make games. And that was sort of the other missing piece that had been there for a long time of surely game development is really expensive and time consuming and costly. That's totally true. It is. But you don't have to have like a computer science degree. Like you don't have to pay a ton of money for software. As long as you have a computer, or again, pen and paper, you can start making games of your own. And so I started seeing these barriers just fall away. And in the meantime, I had picked up coding for other stuff, like web development type things. And that really boosted my confidence for doing things in Unity and video games. It's like, well, I like coding a lot. That's really clicking for me. And so... Yeah, it just sort of spiraled out of control from there. And yeah, I just love making games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Little silly ones. That's all it takes.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What about you, Joe? Like what originally drew you into it?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of game developers' origin stories are pretty similar. Because, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I got an NES when I was around 4, I think, or maybe 3 or so. And I remember asking my dad at one point, you know, I was like, hey, where do people make games? Like, how are these made? Cause I've been playing like Mario and Zelda and Alien Syndrome and all of these like crazy,
you know, the big three.
Yeah. The big three, you know, I asked him and his response was to, take a game that I did not care very much about, which in this case was actually Alien Syndrome. and he opened up the plastic casing and explained to me how microchips were made in factories as well as he could, not being a technical person. And so I was like, cool, that sounds terrible. and so I kind of like put the idea of making games on hold for a long time. I guess like the reason why I kind of started was I was in my senior year of college getting an English degree, a poetry degree actually, and I had just sort of I was sitting in a sociology class and I was just like, I don't want to do this, like I don't want to like write poetry, this is terrible, no offense to all the poets out there, I don't like it. and so I stopped paying attention to any of my classes and started just sort of doodling ideas for games. I had heard at some point that like you need to figure out one of the core skills involved in game development if you want to like actually make it, because you can't just be sort of a designer, which I think is maybe fundamentally untrue at this point, but I decided to focus on art, and so that's what I did. Does that answer the question?
yeah. It's interesting because we've talked a little bit about this off mic before, but I think we have similar origin stories, even more so than all game developer origin stories are fairly similar in a lot of ways, in that I didn't have a computer for a long time. I didn't have a computer of my own until I was in college. Mm-hmm. Now, computers existed well before that. I'm old, but I'm not that old. They were around. Our family just didn't have one. So I didn't really have the language to understand like what a computer, like how it worked on the inside or anything like that. And I also got an English degree as well. Only afterwards realizing I probably should have done like a computer science degree,
right,
or something.
Yeah.
Because later on in my professional life, I did start, I worked at a marketing company that had a burgeoning sort of web development aspect to it. And just talking with those people and hearing how they communicated was really, really interesting to me. And I realized that I am endlessly fascinated by things working, scripting something and making it work and it working reliably all of the time. Consistent input, consistent output was just endlessly like invigorating to me. I was very interested in that. And I even thought back like previously in high school and stuff, like I loved spreadsheets. That's how much of a nerd I am. I worked at Walmart during college, and one of my favorite things to do when I worked there, other than trying not to work, was in the back when we'd get a truck, we'd pull the pallets off the truck and put them up you know, in the I don't know what they were called, the shelves, the big giant warehouse shelves. Mm-hmm. But finding ways to make all of the stuff from the truck fit on those shelves, mm-hmm. I just loved doing that. Everyone else hated it. Yeah, it was just like a Tetris thing. I was like, there was this logic to it that made sense to me, and I loved it so much. So I didn't get into game development until much, much later. I don't have any sort of history of programming. I'm learning programming right now coding, I guess I should say, more accurately, probably, as much as I possibly can. I'm learning all of that. But what does keep me going and what keeps me motivated, and I do want to talk a little bit about with you, each of you, like, what is it that keeps you motivated when you are demotivated? But what really keeps me going is, if I can boil it down to its essence, it's basically just squashing a pesky bug. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how bad my day was. If I find a solution to something that was problematic, I'm like, I'm over the moon, and I'm like, mm-hmm. that's my day. I'm good. And then, and then I can just sort of be happy the rest of the day. So it really comes down to that very specific sort of logic thing, which is surprising to me because growing up, I was the art guy. I was the art kid. I went to a small high school, but ask anyone in the high school, hey, do you know someone who can do this art project? It was always me, mm-hmm. always. Now I am terrible at art. I know nothing about art. I'm awful at it. When I make games, I always am just using boilerplate holding assets that kind of just stay there. I'm very bad at art, but so it does just it's interests me personally that I kind of almost did like a 180, if you can think of those two things as diametrically opposed. But what keeps you guys like motivated when, like, in that similar way, like squashing a pesky bug is for me, like, what is it that's going to turn a bad day into a great day for you in game development?
Yeah. I mean, I had something very similar where I did start out in a lot of ways as an artist and then fell in love with programming because it was all about that problem solving. Mm. And it's for me that really stuck and works in my brain. I do kind of latch on to something like a bug, and I won't let go until I have figured it out, much to the detriment of other things sometimes. I just love trying to solve problems, like figuring out those solutions. And I'm fascinated by all the different ways that you can approach stuff. And there's something incredibly addictive about being able to, especially with game development, write code and then have it do what you told it to do and it works. Mm-hmm. Like I will never forget the first time when I was learning how to do all this that I finally got something to move on the screen. Mm-hmm. Like I'll never forget that moment. It was just like so many lights going off in my brain. Absolutely incredible. And it's sort of that thing that I'm constantly chasing. Mm-hmm. I just want to figure out solutions to weird problems. They're probably problems of my own design, but that's okay because it's a ton of fun. And like the act of like making a game by itself is for me the end game. Like if I finish a game, then awesome. But I like the process of actually creating it and coding and
I love the idea that that fixing a problem of your own design, because what that makes me think of is, you know, coding, it seems like one of those rare things in which you can clearly map out your own, I'm using a grandiose term here, but your own evolution as a person, your own, you know, growth as a person, where I built something that kind of worked. That's nice. I have that data point. I built something that works good. Then I noticed that something about the thing that I had built was broken. So like I'm recognizing the faults of my past, so I'm kind of growing. Mm-hmm. And then I fix this thing, and so it really makes you reflect on how terrible you were back then. And you're like, wow, I really did change as like a person. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Joe? Like what keeps you motivated?
You're totally right about that coding thing too. I do that all the time where I look back at my old stuff and I'm like, wow, I've grown so much since then.
And it makes you, it for me, it demoralizes me too. Cause I realize like, wow, in 3 years, I'm going to like realize how dumb I am right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
It doesn't take 3 years. A lot of time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. 3 weeks probably. I think my favorite thing, the thing I still always enjoy doing is, coming up with basically like a microscopic novel mechanic and then exploring that.
Yeah, yeah.
I very much live in sort of the highly speculative design side of things most of the time. And like you know, exploring these mechanics can take form, take the form of like just writing them down and thinking about them, or it can be like sketching out novel move sets for characters, or it can be exploring some sort of like very strange system in coding. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that, like, for instance, I have been exploring a system to basically represent like liquid dispersing in a top-down pixel art game. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I just sort of like to design toys or like conceptual toys. And then once I try to expand them into entire games, that's sort of where I get tripped up a little bit. I have a tendency to want everything to be its own tiny novel toy. When I think in reality, like you come up with one very novel piece of gameplay and then the rest of the game is sort of like, I don't know, boilerplate stuff that is built around it to make it kind of shine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. That sort of exploration is really where I find my passion, I guess. You know, like sitting people down and going at length about how I came up with a water system where like I can have water of a persistent height and there are two sprites and like one's the bed of the water and one is the top of the water. And then like as it sinks, the sprites get closer together and it duplicates the water in other places. And then you fill up like a little, you can basically like plop a cube of water of any height in like a little Zelda style dungeon. And then it will like equalize itself throughout the dungeon following open paths. And that's what I've been working on currently. It's really silly and simple, but I don't know. I love exploring stuff like that. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, that's very cool. Sorry. I'm just thinking about like, as soon as you like describe that, I'm immediately thinking like, okay, well, how did they do that? Okay, let me think. and I should not do that because we need to move on to our game. We're going to play a game. Are you guys ready to play a game?
Yes.
Yeah,
I heard you guys like games. I don't know if that's true.
Okay. Who told you that?
We'll figure it out. All right. So what we're going to do here is we're going to play a quick game or not quick. I mean, depends on how dumb you guys are.
let's go.
So we're going to play a game called that I've called On Awake. Okay. Ooh. And this is a trivia game in which I ask 5 questions about video game firsts.
Okay. Oh.
And so what you have to do is decide which of the following choices is in fact the first game to do the thing. So for example, if I was to say which was the first Nintendo console that used optical discs and I were to give you the GameCube, the Wonder Swan, or the 64DD, the answer would be
the 64DD.
It's the Wonder Swan.
Oh, you're both wrong. No, it's the GameCube. Yeah, the DD is not an optical drive.
Oh.
But it is a disc drive, yes.
Okay.
Sneaky. Okay, so and they only get sneakier.
Uh-oh.
So fun. But I think this is what I want to do too. In celebration of teamwork, which is what development is, I think what I want to do is I want to have you two be on the same team.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I want to hear you guys kind of discuss, talk about what you think the answer might be. If you get the question right, the point's for you. If you get it wrong, the point's for me. So I'm the DM, I guess. I don't know. I haven't really played much Dungeons & Dragons. Is the DM can the DM be the bad guy?
Oh, totally.
Sure.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Awesome. I'm the bad guy then. All right. Question number 1 of 5.
Okay.
Which of the following games was the first video game to feature parallax scrolling?
Ooh.
Is this A, Jump Bug, B, R-Type, or C, Parallax Sam and the Parallaxing Adventure Through Time in Minnesota, Part 2?
Well, I have a guess. Joe, what do you
I think it's R-Type. I think
that, it's R-Type?
Well, because it's the kind of, you know, R-Type is like it's either a top-down or a side-scrolling shoot-em-up where you're like a spaceship and you're, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
That seems like the kind of game that would do that pretty quickly because they have like, they always have complicated backgrounds and stars and all sorts of things that would be perfect for parallaxing.
My brain went to the Parallax Sam game. I don't know anything about any of these games.
I think that Caleb fabricated that game.
What?
Yeah. Almost positive.
You want to go with R-Type?
I do.
Okay.
That would be a point for me. It is Jump Bug.
Oh.
So the arcade game Jump Bug was released in 1981, and it used a limited form of parallax scrolling with a main scene scrolling while the starry night sky is fixed and the clouds kind of move slowly, adding depth to the scenery. Cool. Now, Irem in 1982 released a side scroller called Moon Patrol, which is considered like popularizing parallax scrolling. Okay. But it wasn't. And a lot of people think of Moon Patrol as the first. But no, it was technically the second. R-Type did have parallax scrolling, but it was released in 1987.
Okay. And you made up the third game.
And I made up the third
one. Yeah, that was a good one. I would have played that game.
So do we get half a point? Because I knew you made up the third game.
I'll have to go to the judges. Oh, they're not here. They didn't show up. I can't answer that for you. I'm sorry. I wish I could. Oh. So, okay. Number two. Which of the following video game characters is Nintendo's first named video game character? Mm. Is it Jumpman? Is it Mr. Game & Watch? Or is it Sheriff?
Oh. I don't know.
So I think that the Game & Watch systems didn't have Mr. Game & Watch until slightly later in their history, but I'm not totally positive about that. So I would actually guess Sheriff, personally.
Sheriff sounds like one, but it also sounds like a made-up one, I don't know for sure.
Sheriff, Sam, and the Parallaxing Adventure Through Time in Minnesota Part 2. That was the full name of the... No, it just Sheriff.
Better not be. There's an assist trophy in Smash Ultimate that is Sheriff. Mm-hmm. It's the really terrible one that shoots incredibly strong bullets all over the place.
Yeah, I hate that guy.
Yeah, he's terrible.
Okay. Yeah, I have no idea.
Okay, well, we're going with Sheriff then.
Yes, point for
you.
Yes. It was Nintendo's first official protagonist. It appeared in the arcade game with the same name back in 1979.
Okay.
Wow.
Not even a Game & Watch system. Right. So I was kind of wrong, but...
2 years before Mario appeared, or Jumpman appeared in Donkey Kong, and 1 year before... Game & Watch and Mr. Game & Watch was created.
Cool.
All right. Three more questions.
Yay.
In what game was the world first introduced to Sonic the Hedgehog? Was it A, Radmobile, B, OutRun, or C, Sonic the Hedgehog?
Sonic has a weird history, but I think it is actually...
I'm almost positive it's actually Sonic the Hedgehog.
I'm leaning towards that. There's something that makes me want to say OutRun, but I would vote...
I
read about this recently.
Is this what always being a DM feels like? Because I love it.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, because I know that Sonic the Hedgehog was the second iteration of the character because he was like an armadillo at first.
Yeah.
And so I would imagine that if there was a game that featured that character archetype, it would have been the armadillo.
Well, and if I remember right, too, Sonic had obviously been in multiple games, but early on it was pretty complicated development history. The studio would start one game and then it would turn into something else, or we stole this character from not stole, that's not the right word, but we took this character and put them into another game. Yeah,
I will say just to keep you from going on down the wrong path, this would be a character that would be recognized as Sonic the Hedgehog. You would see it and you would say, oh, that's Sonic the Hedgehog.
Armadillo Man.
It is not Armadillo Man.
Okay.
I would throw in an asshole question like that. This particular one is not one of those.
Not one. Okay. I'm sorry. What were the options again?
A, Radmobile, B, OutRun, or C, Sonic the Hedgehog.
See, the thing I'm worried about is if Sega put a Sonic decal on a car somewhere.
You might be going down the right path.
So
I kind of want to say OutRun.
All right. I trust you.
You shouldn't.
I know.
We're going to say OutRun.
Yeah, you shouldn't have done that. Radmobile.
Okay.
So it was a racing game developed by Sega AM3 and published by Sega. It was first published in Japan in October 1990, followed by an international release in arcades in February 1991. Mm. Radmobile was Sega's first 32-bit game, and it was also the first appearance of Sonic the Hedgehog, who appears as an ornament hanging from the driver's rearview mirror.
Oh, man.
And that was 5 months before the release of the original Sonic the Hedgehog.
Five months.
Yep. All right. Got two more. I think you guys can do it. These next two are equally absurd. All right.
Yay.
Which of the following games was the first to allow players to play the entire game as a wolf? Okay. As a pretend wolf.
Okay.
It's not a wolf controller. Altered Beast from Sega and Activision. B, Wolf from Manly and Associates and Sanctuary Woods. Or C, Okami from Clover Studio and Capcom.
Oh.
So.
I don't know when any of those came out.
Well, the first one is really old. It's older than Okami for sure. But I think, I don't think you play as a wolf and altered beast, or if you do, I think it's a werewolf situation where you play as a human sometimes.
And this was a wolf through the whole game,
yes,
you said?
Through the entire game, yeah.
I mean, so in Okami, you definitely play as a wolf the entire time. I don't even think there are any sections where you play as a different character for any amount of time, although it's been a while.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the middle game is. Will you repeat what the middle game is?
It's called a wolf. Oh. And it's from a company called Manly and Associates, and published by Sanctuary Woods, maybe?
What consoles was it released for? Can I ask that question?
I'll allow it, because I didn't say you couldn't before, but it might give it away. It's a DOS game.
It's probably the DOS game.
Yeah. Should we go with Wolf?
Yeah. Wolf.
Yes, it is Wolf.
Yay!
1994 DOS game, in which players are cast in the role of a wolf.
Yay!
Roaming around in a sandbox, hunting for food and stuff. It actually sounds incredibly boring.
Cool.
The final question, which I think you're... is it 2-2 right now?
It is 2-2.
Oh, man.
We have 2 points? I thought we had one. Yay.
Here it is. Okay, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, which game won the very first Favorite Video Game Award in Nickelodeon's Kids' Choice Awards?
Oh, God.
Shit.
Was it A, Doom 2, B, Donkey Kong Country, or C, Super Metroid?
Oh, God.
All released in the same year, by the way.
Yeah.
That doesn't help.
It does not. It helps me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't think it's Doom 2.
No?
Doom 1 was really popular, but I don't think Doom 2 was very popular. Okay. I might be wrong about that. I have no idea. It wasn't popular with me.
Your use case is everyone's use case.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then...
Oh, man. I kind of want to say Metroid, but...
See, I think Metroid is a better game than Donkey Kong Country, but...
But it's also Nickelodeon.
Yeah,
Kids
Nickelodeon
Choice
Kids
Awards.
Choice.
Kids are stupid.
Yeah, and like, you know, Donkey Kong Country was... I feel like Super Metroid wasn't a huge deal when it came out.
Oh, like, yeah, it was more cult-like, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible game, and I'm sure everybody immediately loved it, but I think that Donkey Kong Country had those, like... it had some sort of like crazy graphics engine that made it really pretty, so everybody was talking about it all the time.
Should we go with that one?
Yeah, I think we should go with Donkey Kong Country.
Final answer, Donkey Kong
Country. You guys are winners!
Yes!
Donkey Kong Country. So although the Kids' Choice Awards started in 1988, the category for favorite video game didn't emerge until 1995.
Cool.
And that proved that kids don't have great taste in video games, I guess. Because I think Super Metroid should have absolutely won.
Sure,
that.
But Donkey Kong Country is really
good. It's really good.
Good,
you're right. It's absolutely fantastic. I played it all through recently, and it holds up beautifully.
Sure.
So, well, that was a lot of fun. let's round this episode out, shall we? So we talked about lots of games, actually. We talked about Sweet Home. I almost said Home Sweet. We talked about Sweet Home. We talked about Luigi's Mansion 3. We talked a little bit about Doki Doki Literature Club. We had a fun game in which I lost. So I'll come back fighting next time. But before we go, I just want to thank all of you for getting to the very end of this first episode of the Flyover Indies podcast. Podcasting like game development works best when done in iterative steps. So please join us in our iterative spiral toward the gooey nougat center that is game development perfection, which you can do so by giving us some feedback. So email us at contact@flyoverindies.party. That's correct, right?
Yes, that's
awesome.
Correct.
Or at Twitter at flyoverindies. And just tell us what you thought about this first episode. And if you thought nothing, then maybe just answer the question, why did you listen to this episode? All right.
How did you even hear about
What happened to your life? You must have a really good friend. But before we go, let's also, I want to make sure the listeners know where they can reach out to you if you so wish to be reached out to. I'll start with Joe. Joe, where can listeners find you?
I think probably the best way to get a hold of me is to go to my website, which is joevideogameshanna.com. That's Joe, J-O, Hannah, H-A-N-N-A.
You want to spell video games too?
No, it's not.
Is there a space
fine.
In there? There, or
there
a dash
are no dashes and no spaces. I have contact links on my website, and you can look at my work and stuff. So it's
awesome.
Cool.
Awesome. Yeah. And Charlotte?
You can most easily find me on Twitter. It is at CTRBLE. And I'm on there lurking, and come say hi.
Yeah. Twitter for me too, at Caleb J. Ross, all one word. CALEBJROSS. Or website we find too. The website thrown out, I'll do the same thing. It's CalebJRoss.com. Thank you all so much for listening. This has been super fun for me. I hope it's been fun for you too as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And join us for episode 2, will you please?
More games.